Chapter 25. The Completion of the Canon. The Apostle Peter said there were two people who had the authority from Christ to canonize the New Testament. They were himself and the Apostle John. They were the only ones by 66-67 CE who remained alive as witnesses of the transfiguration of Christ. Peter, in his second epistle, said this majestic event gave them a special authorization to receive and to record inspired teachings from God. They had the word of prophecy more confirmed, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. They ranked with the prophets who composed works for the inspired Old Testament. This gave Peter and John the right to select and authorize any documents they saw fit in order to leave the Christian community with official documents that would last them until the day dawn, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. This, in summary, was the teaching of Peter in the first chapter of his second epistle. The one who carried Peter's selected documents to the Apostle John was probably John Mark. When Mark left Rome with those documents, Paul was already dead and Peter was near death, if not already dead. Certainly by late 67 CE, John was the only apostle remaining who had witnessed the transfiguration. The responsibility for putting the finishing touches to the canon of the New Testament fell to him. This was in accord with Christ's prophecy that Peter was to die a martyr, but that John would continue to live until I am coming. John chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. This did not mean that John himself would not die, as some began to imagine, because Christ made it clear that the two sons of thunder, John and his brother James, would be killed for their faith. Matthew chapter 20, verse 23. John's brother James was the first of the apostles to be slain, Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And history informs us that John also met his death through martyrdom. Yet John was prophesied to tarry on earth until the coming of Christ. As explained in a previous chapter, this was a reference to a role that John was to play that would effectively keep him alive and active until the second advent of Christ. What does the phrase, "tarry till I come," mean in regard to John continuing to live until the second advent? Let us note a principle of literary composition in early times that will help to explain this role of the Apostle John continuing to be alive for the next 20 centuries or more. It is an interesting and important biblical point to consider. The example of Paul. The literary principle that we need to understand is found in the Apostle Paul's second epistle to the Corinthians. It involves a statement made by the Apostle Paul that hardly anyone understands today, and this includes many scholars, but its meaning is quite clear and meaningful if one will simply pay close attention to what Paul stated, and especially what Paul meant. In writing his second letter to the Corinthians, Paul stated a literary principle which accompanied that letter. The text is pretty clear in the King James Version, but to make the matter even plainer, I will give a more literal translation directly from the Greek to show us of modern times what Paul wrote to the Corinthians in his second letter. "This is the third time I am coming to you. At the mouth of two witnesses or of three, every matter must be established. I have said previously, and as if present the second time and yet absent, now I say in advance of my coming to you, to those who have sinned before and to all the rest, that if ever I come again, I will not spare in my judgment upon the guilty." 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, Greek. Look at what Paul meant. It is plain when one analyzes the context. Paul said he was at that very time coming into the presence of the Corinthians at the very moment of writing 2 Corinthians, yet he said this coming to them was his third time to be in their presence. His third time? What does Paul mean by third time? The only other visit to Corinth, and when he stayed for 18 months, was when he was there as recorded in Acts chapter 18. There is no record of him being in Corinth a second time. That is, there is no record of a second visit in the flesh by him actually going to them in person. Yet he said in 1 Corinthians that he went to them a second time, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. But in those two verses in 1 Corinthians, Paul said he came to the Corinthians by letter and not in person. He said, "I verily, as absent in body but present in spirit, have judged already as though I were present." That is, when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, he reckoned that very letter to be looked on as though he were present and that he in person was accompanying that letter which we call 1 Corinthians. Later, when writing 2 Corinthians, Paul stated his readiness to come to them once more. This is the third time I am in readiness to come to you. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 14. Indeed, he got more specific 8 verses later by saying, "This is the third time I am coming, present tense, to you," as if present the second time and yet absent. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. In simple terms, Paul meant that this third visit of his to the Corinthians was in the same fashion and in the identical manner as his second visit had been, as if present, yet absent. This means that both his second visit and his third visit to Corinth were just like his presence with the Colossians when he wrote his letter to them. Paul said, "Though I be absent in the flesh, yet am I with you in the spirit." Colossians chapter 2, verse 5. His second and third visits were only in spirit, but when they read his two letters to the Corinthians, they were to view Paul as being present in the flesh, as though he was right in their midst. He was telling the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians that his coming to them in the near future would be his fourth visit, when he was planning to be in Corinth in the flesh, verse 2b. But Paul's second and third visits to Corinth were only by his two letters to them. In both 1 and 2 Corinthians, Paul considered his letters to them to be reckoned as if he were with them, as if present, yet absent. Paul even quoted the statement from the Law of Moses about the need for 2 or 3 witnesses, and this means eyewitnesses, as applying to his two letters to the Corinthians. Though they were simply letters from Paul, Paul considered himself as accompanying those letters, as if present, yet absent. In summation, Paul meant that his first visit to Corinth was when he was with them in the flesh for 18 months. His second and third visits were when he wrote to them the epistles of 1 Corinthians, his second visit, and then 2 Corinthians, his third visit. His fourth visit, which he was planning, would once again be a visit in the flesh. It was not an uncommon practice for people around the period when Paul wrote to consider that a letter sent to a person or a group, or even the bearer of the letter, was looked on as if the writer were present when the letter was read. That is, that the letter was looked on as if the person was in their presence. There is the Latin letter to a Roman military tribune century, an official reason for his prophetic role, which states, "Sir, I beg you to look upon him, the bearer of the letter, as if he were myself." Followed a few lines later with, "Look upon this letter, sir, and imagine that I am talking with you." Stanley K. Stowers, in his letter writing in Greco-Roman antiquity, gives several examples of early classical letters that tell those who receive the letters to treat the letter bearer, and consequently the message in the letters, as though the writer were there in person. We should note well this custom because it will have a great bearing on what books of the apostles were accorded more authority in arrangement, as we will see later in this book. It is a principle that is most important to understand. In effect, when Paul wrote 1 and 2 Corinthians, he looked on himself as being present when those letters were read to the Corinthian ecclesia, although he was quite absent from them in the flesh. As Paul explained it, as if present, yet absent. This also helps to understand the prophecy that Christ stated to John that he would continue until I come. One of the keys to understanding what Christ meant when he said that the Apostle John would continue to be present with Christians until his second advent is a similar thing that Paul acknowledged in reference to his writing of 1 and 2 Corinthians. Though Paul was not actually present in the midst of the Corinthians when he wrote his two letters, whether by geographically being separated from them or whatever, so John also would continue to be present with all those who would read his writings until the second advent, because the writings of John, in the New Testament way of looking at things, would be reckoned as present when his letters would be read. Paul gave a similar principle in Romans chapter 4, verse 17, when he said that God calls those things which be not as though they were. That is right. From a New Testament point of view, every time you read the writings of Paul or John, or indeed James, Peter, and Jude, it is reckoned by New Testament custom that those men are present with you, though they really are not. Most have been dead for over 1,900 plus years and still are dead awaiting their resurrections. The Apostle John was thus to remain on earth and to be reckoned as a living person through the writings he would leave for future Christians. So, when one reads John's works, though he himself is dead, he is alive and with us through his writings. Among those writings of John was the book of Revelation about the events surrounding the time of the second advent of Christ. Historical and biblical evidence points to two time periods for the composition of this prophetic book. The first writing of it, in its initial form, was about 56 to 60 CE. It was revealed again, perhaps with more material added to the original text, in the last part of the first century. Irenaeus, who was a native of Asia Minor and who knew Polycarp, who in turn was a personal acquaintance of the Apostle John, said that the book of Revelation was seen not such a long time ago, but almost in our own generation at the end of the reign of Domitian. This reference is powerful evidence that John received the visions, at least in their final form, when he was a very old man. Indeed, Irenaeus said that John lived in the city of Ephesus until the time of the Emperor Trajan, 98 through 117 CE. According to Papias, bishop of Hierapolis near Ephesus and a contemporary of John, John was martyred by the Jews. The fact that John had a long history of living and working in the region of Ephesus is well attested and need not be seriously doubted. We will see, however, that John was also in personal contact with Christian authorities in Jerusalem, who returned to the area after 70 CE. But John was also frequently in Western Asia Minor. Irenaeus stated that John composed his gospel while at Ephesus, and since the book of Revelation was restored to relevance and was canonized as a book concerning the end times, as well as written to the seven congregations in Western Asia Minor, it can be reasonably accepted that this area was also important as a Christian center after 70 CE. But this does not mean that Jerusalem and its environs were not important. We will come to see as we progress in this book that Jerusalem, more particularly the Mount of Olives, remained a strong center for Christianity, and it lasted until the time of Eusebius in the 4th century. The Canonization by the Apostle John. John did not create the New Testament on his own. He had helpers. If one will read the writings of John carefully, these assistants can be recognized, and they played a very important part in the overall canonization. References to them are found from time to time cropping up within the contexts of John's compositions. The elders who helped John were very important. We will see in a moment that many of them were eyewitnesses to the teachings of Jesus in Judea, and they also saw him alive after his resurrection from the dead. They were a part of those 500 people still alive in 55 CE, whom Paul said were witnesses to Christ's resurrected body, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6. This means that they were certainly Jewish Christians. The best place to start in order to observe this circle of John's helpers is at the very end of John's gospel. Throughout his 21 chapters, we find the apostle recording what Christ taught along with John's own comments being given from time to time. But when one reaches John chapter 21, verse 24, just before the end of the gospel, there is a remark in the text that interjects what others besides John had to say about the gospel of John. Notice the verse. This is the disciple, John, who bears witness about these things, and we know that the witness he gives is true. John chapter 21, verse 24. Notice the abrupt change from the third person singular to the plural. The last part of this verse is introducing further witnesses other than John, who are identified only by the pronoun we. Who were these men? In the gospel, they are not identified, but it can reasonably be assumed that the first readers of John's gospel must have been aware of their identities. They must have represented an officially recognized body of men, since they boldly gave their witness to John's written word. And we know that the witness he, John, gives is true. But there is more. The we passages do not stop with the single verse at the end of John's gospel. They occur elsewhere in John's writings. Notice the short epistle called 3 John. John began to speak to a man called Gaius in the first person singular. I pray that in all things you may be prospering and have good health. Verse 2. Then we find a long string of I rejoiced, verse 3. I am thankful, verse 4. I wrote, verse 9, and I will call to remembrance, verse 10. But then, and out of the blue, John introduces a plural intrusion into the text. In this book, it says, In fact, we also are bearing witness, and you know that the witness we give is true. Verse 12. Then immediately the context of 3 John returns to, I had many things to write you, yet I do not wish to go on writing you with ink and pen, but I am hoping to see you directly. Verses 13 and 14. It is clear that a body of men, other than John himself, were telling the readers of John's third epistle that they too were witnesses to the truth that John was stating. These assistants or editors of John must have been well known to John's readers. All they say is, you know that the witness we give is true. Certainly these men could reasonably be considered a group of John's right-hand men and known by all. There is even more. In John's first epistle, we find the insertion of another we section. Notice 1 John chapter 4, verse 11. After John told his readers that I am writing, 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, followed by further references to I am writing or I write in verses 7 and 8 and 12 and 13 three times, verse 14 twice, as well as I write in verses 21 and 26, there is then interjected into the context, In addition, we ourselves have beheld and are bearing witness that the Father has sent forth His Son as Savior of the world. 1 John chapter 4, verse 14. This shows, once again, an intrusion into the text. This was a deliberate attempt to interpose the witness of a body of men other than the Apostle John. After these men had included their witness, we find John returning to his I write you motif, 1 John chapter 5, verse 13. These references indicate that there were other men clearly known by the original readers of John's Gospel and his first and third epistles who wanted to make sure that they were adding their testimonies to the truth of what John was saying. Who were these other witnesses? Thankfully, it is possible to identify these men in a general way, although we have not been told their names. Since the we sections in John's Gospel and his first and third epistles are very similar in content and purpose, it can be reasonably believed that they all represented the same group of men who were assistants or editors of John. If this is the case, then we can know more about them because in the first chapter of John's first epistle, these men are further identified. In fact, the whole of the first chapter gives a rundown of the authority that they had, along with John, in the Christian community. They must have been associated with John between the years of 67 CE and 98 CE. Note carefully the first chapter of 1 John. So that the authority of these men can come into better view, the whole of the chapter needs to be mentioned. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have viewed and our hands felt, concerning the word of life, and the life was made manifest, and we have seen and are bearing witness and reporting to you the everlasting aeonian life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we are reporting unto you, that you may be sharing, having fellowship, with us. Furthermore, this sharing fellowship of ours is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ, and so we are writing these things, that our joy may be in full measure. 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, Greek. The we section continues on through the first chapter of 1 John, but abruptly, in chapter 2, there is a change to the first person singular. My little children, I write unto you, verse 1. This continues until chapter 4, verse 14 is reached, and then there is the single verse which again records a we section. Once their final witness is recorded, John closes with the usual, I write you these things, chapter 5, verse 13. Whoever these men were, they figured very prominently in the writing of John's three epistles. But more than that, they were men from Palestine who had been personal acquaintances of Christ, and they were witnesses of His resurrection from the dead. This put them into a relatively high position of authority. After all, how many people in the first century could claim such distinction? Even the Apostle Paul knew in 55 CE of only about 500 who were so honored, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6. These men were certainly a part of that group. They may even have been of more esteem in the eyes of Christians at the time. Indeed, if one will look at the very beginning of the Gospel of John, these same men gave their own witness, along with John, to the glory of Christ which they had seen with their own eyes. In John's first chapter, there is a prominent and even glaring "we" section. But strangely, most people pass right over it as though it is not even there. It is time that people begin to pay attention to what the text actually says, rather than hurrying over this section of John in a haphazard fashion to get to the next section. If people would slow down and read what John wrote, many would be in for some real surprises. Notice an important "we" section at the very start of John's Gospel. "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." John chapter 1, verse 14. Scholars are aware that this interjection is the separate witness by John's assistants or editors, but the vast majority of readers of the New Testament simply pass over this reference so quickly that they do not notice the relevance of it. It is time to restore the testimony of these men to its proper place. Who were these men who interposed their own testimonies at crucial points in the texts of John? One thing is assured, they were almost certainly Jewish because they were witnesses of Christ in the flesh before his crucifixion and after his resurrection. Both the references in John chapter 1, verse 14, and 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4 show this. As mentioned before, the Apostle Paul said there were more than 500 people who saw Christ after his resurrection, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6, and we can be certain that the majority of them, if not all, were of Jewish ancestry. Were some of these witnesses with the Apostle John near the end of the first century? An early Christian called Quadratus wrote a short letter to the Emperor Hadrian in 117 CE, saying that he, no doubt in his youth, had talked to some people whom Christ had raised from the dead. This would mean that about the 90s CE there were some witnesses of Christ's ministry in the flesh still living. They may well have been remaining with John and helping him in the writing of his gospel and his three epistles. They may even have added a few remarks to John's works after John's death, if they thought it was necessary to do so. After all, the official scribes of the Jews added genealogical matters to the temple scrolls down to the time of Alexander the Great, some 100 years after the close of the Old Testament canon. There would be nothing wrong in adding a few editorial remarks to the divine library of New Testament books if the elders who supported the Apostle John were still alive after John's death. These suggestions can make sense. The fact is, there appear to be a number of such editorial remarks in John's Gospel, either in relation to the "we" sections or distinct from them. The King James Version shows some of them by placing their occurrences within parentheses. For example, John chapter 3, verse 13 states, "And no man has ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven." Obviously, the words represent a later editorial remark because Christ was certainly on earth when he uttered the first part of the verse, but only after his resurrection was he actually in heaven. There is John chapter 4, verse 23. "Christ said to the Samaritan woman, But the hour comes, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth." Christ was telling her that the temple at Jerusalem was no longer to be important, but at the time Christ mentioned his teaching to the Samaritan woman, the temple was still the proper site for assembly. But the editors, at the time the gospel was canonized, put in the reference, "and now is," to show that what Christ had predicted had now come true. Another is John chapter 5, verse 25. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." The words are a later insertion which could only have been stating the truth after the resurrection of Lazarus and those who were made alive after Christ's resurrection. John chapter 11, verses 1 through 46, Matthew chapter 27, verses 52 and 53. Another verse is John chapter 13, verse 3. "Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God, and went to God." The words, again, are a later editorial remark. There is also John chapter 17, verse 3. Jesus was talking and said, "And this is life eternal, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." And lastly, let us note John chapter 19, verse 35. "And he that saw it bore record, and his record is true, and he knows that he says true, that you might believe." The Assistance of John. One thing that becomes evident about the "we" sections of John is that most of the men who composed them were part of that special and select group around John who had been Christians from the very beginning. Their remarks in the Gospel indicate that they had seen the glory of Christ firsthand, John chapter 1, verse 14. And in John's first epistle, they emphasized their seeing, their handling, and their hearing Christ speak, 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. This may mean that some of them were other apostles or certainly a part of the 500 who witnessed Christ alive after his resurrection, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6. It can almost be certain that they were all Jews and that they later lived near John when he was performing his job of canonizing the New Testament. These men were those that could be called elders that helped John in the canonization. Papias, around 110 CE, makes an interesting comment about the elders who were the disciples of John and who succeeded him. "Since Papias was in contact with these elders and was interested in their testimonies concerning the early truths taught by Christ and the apostles, his comments are valuable. Note what he said. But I shall not hesitate also to put down for you along with my interpretations whatsoever things I have at my time learned from the elders and carefully remembered, guaranteeing their truth. For I did not, like the multitude, take pleasure in those that speak much, but in those that speak the truth. Not in those that relate strange commandments, but in those that deliver the commandments given by the Lord to faith and springing from the truth itself. If, then, anyone came who had been a follower of the elders, questioned him in regard to the words of the elders, what Andrew or what Peter said, or what was said by Philip or by Thomas or by James or by John or by Matthew or by any other of the disciples of the Lord, and what things Ariston and the presbyter John, the disciples of the Lord, say. For I did not think that what was to be gotten from the books would profit me as much as what came from the living and abiding voice." This account makes it clear that the apostles were dead by the time Papias made this remark about 110 CE, but there was still a body of elders who had first-hand knowledge of what many of the apostles had taught. Papias said he even preferred to speak with them about the teachings they presented about Christ rather than to resort to the books, which also recorded such things. This seems to make it clear that there already was, within a very few years of the Apostle John's death, a set of books which were regularly being consulted concerning the teachings of Christ and the apostles. At the same time Papias was making his statements, Polycarp, a disciple of the Apostle John who had certainly heard him speak, was collecting the seven letters of Ignatius, which Ignatius wrote while on his way to Rome to be martyred. If the seven letters of Ignatius were so important and precious to Polycarp and to be preserved for posterity and distributed to other Christian communities, then it would seem odd that Polycarp did not possess a complete canon of New Testament books, which he would have considered infinitely more sacred. Indeed, Polycarp said in the same letter that the Philippians were well trained in the sacred writings, which he called the Scriptures, and then he quoted from Paul's letter to the Ephesians. But besides having the sacred writings in his possession, there were still alive some of the elders who remembered the apostles personally. The elders that Papias referred to as being alive just after the death of John might have been the very ones who helped John in the final canonization of the New Testament that were mentioned in the "we" passages previously mentioned. Were they part of John's select group of men? This seems to be the case, and indeed some of them may have been a few of the very apostles themselves and other Palestinian Christians. After all, 1 John chapter 1 says that those designated by the pronoun "we" were those who had seen and handled Christ as well as having been witnesses of his resurrection. 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. The importance of John's elders. There is another historical reference to the elders who helped John write his gospel and his three epistles. It is what we today call the Muratorian canon, named after L.A. Muratori, who discovered the document in 1740 CE. It is an account of how some of the books of the New Testament came to be. Though it is written in barbarous Latin and scholars have argued about its intrinsic worth for years, there are some interesting matters mentioned by the document that refer to the "we" passages of the Apostle John's writings. And because it has often been dated very early to about 150 CE, though this is disputed, it provides a reasonable witness of what people believed about the origin of the Gospel of John and other books. It will pay us to quote an extensive part of the Muratorian canon. In this section, I will transcribe it. The main topic was the Gospel of John. The fourth gospel is by John, one of the disciples. When his fellow disciples and overseers of the churches exhorted him, he said, "Today fast with me for 3 days, and let us recount to each other whatever may be revealed to each of us." That same night it was revealed to Andrew, one of the apostles, that John should write down all things in John's name, as they all recalled them to mind or could certify to John. So although various points are taught in the several books of the Gospels, yet it makes no difference to the faith of believers, since all things in them are declared by one supreme Spirit, concerning Christ's nativity, his sufferings, his resurrection, his talking with his disciples, and his double advent, that is, his two separate advents, the first in despised lowliness, which has taken place, and the second glorious with the power of a king, which is yet to come. What wonders, then, if John so boldly presents each point, saying of himself in his epistle, "What we have seen with our eyes and heard with our ears and our hands have handled, these things have we written?" For so he swears as a witness, not only one who saw Christ and a hearer of him, but he was also a writer of all the wonderful works of the Lord in order. There can be no doubt that the writer of this work believed that the Gospel of John, though written under the name of the beloved disciple John, was really a cooperative effort in which several of the apostles and disciples took part. And in effect, this is exactly what the "we" sections of the Gospel of John and John's epistles demand. This makes the elders of John take on an importance that many people have not realized. It indicates that John became the writer for the remaining witnesses of Christ who were still alive at the end of the first century. John's circle of friends included some of the most illustrious luminaries who accompanied Christ in his preaching tours of Galilee and Judea. These elders of John were also mentioned by Clement of Alexandria, early 3rd century CE, when he discussed the method that John used in writing his gospel. He said, "But last of all, John, perceiving that the observable facts had been made plain in the gospel, those formerly written, being urged on by friends and inspired by the Spirit, composed a spiritual gospel, as quoted by Eusebius, Ecclesiastical History 6.14.7. This means that sometime between 70 CE and his death about 98 CE, or thereabouts, since John lived to the time of the Emperor Trajan, John was asked by his friends to write a spiritual gospel, and in this case, they were those who had, with him, seen and heard Christ and had been witnesses of Christ's resurrection. John accomplished that task, and it proved to be not just the work of John alone, but a cooperative effort involving the remaining witnesses who personally observed Christ and his teachings. Though Peter and Paul died in Rome, and they had made the first preliminary canonization of the New Testament, it remained for John and his eyewitness elders to complete the final written testimony to the teachings of Christ. This was accomplished in the last decade of the first century. There are many reasons to show that the Gospel of John was written last of all the Gospels, and that it was no doubt composed just before John's death. One of the main things to show this is John's appeal that the Holy Spirit Christ had promised would recall to mind all the essential teachings of Christ. "But the Comforter, which is the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he shall teach you all things and bring to remembrance whatsoever things I have said unto you." John chapter 14, verse 26. Since John was a very old man when his gospel was written, there were people accusing him of not being able to remember the real teachings of Christ. This is why John invoked the witness of the Holy Spirit to counter this. But John was also, in his gospel and epistles, constantly appealing to the truth provided by competent witnesses from Palestine. In his gospel alone, John stressed the word witness, or its cognates, 47 times. This was a most unusual emphasis. Why did John resort to such an appeal? No other writer of the New Testament had to constantly remind his readers that he had many kinds of witnesses to the truth of what he was writing. But no other writer was being accused of being too old to remember the truths of earlier times. The fact is, when John wrote his gospel, there were many people in the world who began to question the accuracy of it and the competence of John himself. This is one of the main reasons that John emphasized that the Holy Spirit was promised by Christ to bring back a remembrance of all the truth to his apostles. John chapter 16, verse 13. And if that were not enough, John also called on a group of his select friends, the elders of the We passages, who were also eyewitnesses to all that he was saying, and they also vouched for the truth of his statements. It should be recalled that there were many Gospels of Christ already circulating by the time John wrote his works, Luke chapter 1, verse 1, and that both Peter and Paul warned of the fables that were destined to be put forth as the truth, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, and 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 4. John, even in his old age, felt that it was incumbent upon him to clear the air with the truth. He thus asked the witnesses of Christ's earthly life who were still living, the elders, to cooperate with him in the production of the final gospel. This was done just before John's death, about the time he canonized the book of Revelation. It is for this reason that many features of John's gospel can be satisfactorily explained. This is why he could record the incident of Lazarus being resurrected from the dead, while the other three gospel accounts did not wish to do so. Since Lazarus was now likely dead and this would prevent any harassment from his admirers or his foes, John could tell the story in detail. But John left out things too. There is no mention of Christ's prophecies about the destruction of Jerusalem, to which the other three Gospels paid considerable attention. It would have been unwise to mention matters that many had considered as already taken place and record them as future prophecies. And, after all, the Olivet prophecies had been adequately covered by the other three Gospels written before the destruction of Jerusalem. John's task was different and for other reasons. He was simply giving a summary of doctrinal and spiritual matters taught by Christ that the other apostles had left out or did not feel necessary to record. His gospel was a spiritual one. The transition period. The time between the deaths of Peter and Paul, about 67 CE in Rome, and that of John, soon after 98 CE, was most significant in the history of the canonization. Some of the differences in the contents of later manuscripts can be attributed to this period of 30 years. For example, it must be acknowledged that Peter and Paul left with the Christians at Rome a partial canon of New Testament scriptures, though Peter directed the actual and final canonization to his readers in Asia Minor, and most particularly to the Apostle John himself, who must have been resident among them at the time. The whole of Peter's second epistle is devoted to this subject. It was the Apostle John to whom one must look, according to Peter, for the final canonization. The Christian community at Rome was also important and needed the divine canon in their midst. In fact, all the ecclesias, churches, needed to know what writings were considered canonical to ensure proper teaching. It is reasonable to suppose that Peter and Paul left a partial canon with the ecclesia at Rome, the same they sent to John, which would last them until John would include his own books and complete the divine library. Since John's gospel, his three epistles, and the book of Revelation were not canonized for almost another 30 years or so, it meant that the Christian communities did not have in their possession a complete New Testament until the last decade of the first century. This period, when no full canon was yet available, can explain a great deal of the minor and even major differences that arose in a few of the early manuscripts. For instance, the original Gospel of Mark, which Peter dictated to John Mark in Rome, and that Mark left with the Roman Christians, probably did not contain the long conclusion, chapter 16, verses 9 through 20, or even a short conclusion of one verse which followed Mark chapter 16, verse 8. Thus, for a period of 30 or 35 years, some manuscripts were circulating without the long conclusion. Yet when John and his assistants, the elders, finally canonized the New Testament, 12 verses were added to the Gospel of Mark in order to complete it. Even the book of Acts had come down to us in two distinct types of manuscript versions, one which is more replete with historical and geographical information, adding about 10% more material to the text. The additions to Acts could also have been made when the final canon was published at the end of the century. There is also the question of the exact times John wrote his Gospel and three epistles. The Gospel seems to be a late production, though John's mention of five porches as seemingly in existence in Jerusalem, chapter 5, verse 3, and the reference that Peter will be martyred, chapter 21, verse 19, might indicate the basic writing of the Gospel was early, even before the destruction of Jerusalem. Professor John A.T. Robinson, in his excellent book, Redating the New Testament, thought this to be the case. John's mention that it was the last hour, 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, would tend to put the original writing quite early, before the apostles came to see that Christ was not coming back in that generation. While all of this may show an early first draft to John's Gospel and epistles, the inclusion of the "we" sections into their texts make it probable that their final positioning within the divine canon only became a reality when the book of Revelation was revealed again to the Apostle John not long before his death. Actually, the "we" sections seem to be editorial remarks which were added by John's assistants, either to buttress the reliability of what John was writing in his old age or to support John's testimony after his death. From our present state of knowledge, we cannot know when during those 30 or 35 years after the fall of Jerusalem that John wrote his Gospel and the three epistles. Certainly, though, they were not canonized as official parts of the New Testament until the last book, Revelation, was accepted again and canonized for all Christians near John's death. Conclusion. It is sometimes thought that because the New Testament has come down to us in Greek, that the Gentiles from Greek-speaking areas were the ones who had authority to preserve the new canon. There is no scriptural warrant to sustain this belief. Indeed, of the apostles themselves, only Peter and John had the prophetic word more confirmed, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. These two apostles, along with James, the Lord's brother, were the pillar apostles in the Christian communities, and even the apostle Paul found it necessary to gain an approbation from them for his work among the Gentiles, Galatians chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. In a particular sense, they were the only apostles specifically commissioned to go to the circumcised, Galatians chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. As far as Holy Scripture was concerned, it was a well-known principle among the Jews that it was they who had been authorized to preserve and protect and to teach the Word of God. Paul acknowledged this. What advantage, then, has the Jew? Or what profit is there of circumcision? Much every way, chiefly because unto them were committed the oracles of God. Romans chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. The word committed signifies an entrustment, an official commission. The Apostle Paul reckoned that his own ministry among the Gentiles had the same type of authority, and the identical word was used in Greek to describe it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 17, Galatians chapter 2, verse 7, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 11, and Titus chapter 1, verse 3. Since the Old Testament had been placed into the hands of the temple priests for its teaching and preservation, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 9 through 11, the apostles must have looked on safeguarding the New Testament in a similar way. Recall that the Apostle John and his brother James were of priestly descent, and these beliefs are compatible to the teachings of the New Testament as we have shown. This gave John, at the end of the first century, an official reason for his prophetic role of finalizing the New Testament canon. At any rate, Peter told the Jewish exiles in Asia Minor that he and John were going to leave them with a New Testament canon, and that only these two apostles had the word of prophecy more confirmed. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. To accomplish his role in canonization, the Apostle John gathered around him near the end of the first century a body of Jewish elders who helped him in writing and no doubt preserving that canon. No one knows how long the original group of men assisted John, but at the time John wrote his gospel and his three epistles, those men were still giving witness to the accuracy of John's teaching. In the next chapter, we will see that the Apostle John, even though he was an apostle of Christ, was looked on with suspicion by some Christians near the end of the first century. This is an important point to realize in the matter of New Testament canonization.